I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Housing First is an alternative to temporary shelters. It provides the chronically homeless with immediate access to permanent independent housing. And it is not contingent on meeting sobriety. The program provides support for challenges that many chronically homeless face, like substance abuse. It was first introduced in New York in 1992 and initially had to go through therapy, treatment, and transitional housing before you were housing ready. Housing First flips that model, and it offers housing and then treatment, specifically targeting chronically homeless individuals with mental illness. It is taking place in Madison, Wisconsin. It's taking place in Milwaukee, and it's also taking place in cities throughout the country, and also it's moving into other parts of the country beyond cities. We're going to have several guests with us during the course of the hour. Ed Stellan is Executive Director of Heartland Health Outreach, which is also part of the Heartland Alliance, and we welcome you to the show. Hello, Ed. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it, and I really appreciate your interest in talking about homelessness. It's a topic near and dear to my heart.
Yeah, I'm glad we're going to talk about it as well. Michael Goldberg is also joining us. He's Executive Director of Heartland Housing and also a part of Heartland Alliance, and he will be joining us later in the hour. And County Executive Chris Abley, Milwaukee County Executive, will also join us to talk about efforts here in Milwaukee. We'll be welcoming phone calls during the course of the hour, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. So, Ed, tell me, why is this model, this flip of what you would normally think, well, we'll do treatment programs and then housing, why is Housing First an important concept?
Well, you know, first and foremost, Housing First is actually something that's been studied for about 20 years now. And you're right, starting in work that was done in New York, but it's been studied in many cities across the United States. And so one of the great things about Housing First is that it's evidence-based. It's been shown to work with a subset of homeless people, chronically homeless people, people who usually have co-occurring health conditions and, like you said before, behavioral health conditions. So it's actually been demonstrated to work much better than traditional approaches with this particular population, the chronically homeless.
Mm-hmm. And how widespread is it now?
Oh, it's really very widespread throughout the country. Housing and Urban Development, HUD, embraced Housing First a good 5 to 7 years ago and really encouraged all of their the programs they fund. They are the driver, the primary funder of solutions to homelessness nationwide. They really pushed and encouraged, maybe forced in some cases, cities to really embrace the model.
Mm-hmm. And you are a nonprofit developer. You have brought the Housing First approach to Madison, to other places as well?
Yeah. So I am the executive director of Heartland Health Outreach. We're the healthcare for the homeless provider for Chicago. And we got involved in Housing First. Inadvertently, we got involved in Housing First in the mid-1990s because we were basically housing chronically homeless individuals with serious mental illness and then providing them supports. And a few years later, we heard this term, Housing First, and we thought, wow, that's what we're doing. And we embraced that and, you know, really made sure we conform to that model. So we've been doing it in Chicago for quite a while, and now we're very excited to partner with our housing development arm, Heartland Housing, the new project in Madison.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of the treatment, it's a huge thing that's happening here, because not only are people needing to be identified, chronically homeless people needing to be identified and found on the streets, or for families, I know there's a family element too in shelters, but then also all the services are coordinated around where the people are, right? So you've got your house and then you've got treatment which is available to you very close to where you are.
Exactly. You hit the nail on the head. So essentially what we're doing is we're engaging and finding people who are living on the streets or in shelters in Madison, and we're moving them right into housing. And ideally, we're actually looking for the most vulnerable people, the people who've been out there the longest, the people with the most number of health conditions and struggles managing those health conditions, so that housing can become part of their health care, essentially. Often at HHO, we talk about housing as health care. So you're right. What a huge key to housing first is not only the housing component, getting people into housing, but then having a team of really dedicated professional staff members who build a real unique individual relationship with each of the people and then help them navigate the complicated system that exists out there to get their health care and other needs met.
Mm-hmm.
So that includes sometimes bringing services on site. So, for instance, in our project in Madison, which is still quite new, they've partnered with a provider in the community to bring a group, basically kind of a recovery-oriented group, to the building every day at 4 o'clock. And so that's an example of bringing services on site. We do that a lot in Chicago. We bring our own health care that we provide right on site into the permanent housing residences and deliver both primary care and mental health services right there. But in addition to that, the case managers, the workers, they partner with folks and they go out into the world with them. And so if say you have a woman who's been chronically homeless and really struggling to stay on top of her diabetes, easier said than done, the case manager will go with her to the primary care provider, and to the extent that this individual is willing and able, she'll maybe allow the case manager to even be meeting with the doctor with her to help her kind of interpret what that doctor is saying. And then they take that information back to the housing, and they start looking at that and think, well, you know, this is what they told you about your diet. How do you feel about that? How can I help you, you know, stay on top of that? What about checking your blood sugar? Things like this. Maybe giving reminders on when to take those meds, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. And what about for substance abuse? Because this is a difficult issue for so many people. Have you found that there's been success in having people overcome their addictions with this kind of approach?
Yes, and I want to kind of describe this a little differently.
Okay.
At Heartland, we really take what's called a harm reduction approach, and most providers of Housing First would also embrace this approach. But this idea that we're meeting with people, engaging them, bringing them into housing, and some of them are using drugs or alcohol. And we recognize that in that moment, not all of them are ready, willing, or able to discontinue that use. But short of discontinuing use, there's a lot of things that can be done to reduce some of the harm related to that use. A couple things about Housing First. First and foremost, the goal of Housing First is to keep your housing. And we know that a lot of people have lost their housing because of their drug or alcohol use in the
mm-hmm.
past. So we'll have a very open and direct conversation that, you know, Housing First isn't magic. There's a lease, there are rules and expectations just like any of us would have wherever we live. And my job is to partner with you and help you live within and live up to those rules and expectations. So we do know by studies, both through some of the work we've done at Heartland, but then also national studies, that even for folks who move into Housing First and are very committed to continuing to use drugs or alcohol, the overall use of drugs or alcohol declines a lot just from them being off the street. That when they're not out on the street with folks around them using all the time, they just use less. But we also know that there's strategies to help people reduce and even eliminate that use. And it's not traditional. It's not always traditional. It can be, but it's not always traditional. We've had individuals who've decided that they were going to stop one drug, crack cocaine, for instance, because they felt that they were really having a lot of legal troubles and relational troubles related to their crack cocaine. But they decided that they weren't going to stop smoking marijuana. And we recognized that that was a step in the right direction and really helped them do that. A couple people, we've done that, and both of them did really well and actually got back into the workforce.
Mm.
So it's a very flexible and sort of individualized approach.
Mm-hmm.
At HHO, because we're a medical provider, sometimes we also use what's called medication-assisted therapy. And that means, for instance, we had a gentleman who was a very, very heavy alcohol user. And we partnered with him and we said, well, you know, we can prescribe you. He was not interested in not drinking. So we said, well, we can prescribe you a medication, naltrexone, that you would get a shot once a month. And it may just kind of make you drink less. And sure enough, he said, yeah, I'll do that. And he came to us, you know, after a couple days of this working, and said, well, you know, it's so interesting. I used to start drinking it right when I woke up in the morning, you know, 7 or 8 or whenever.
Right.
And now I don't even think about drinking until about 2 or 3 in the afternoon. So there's an example of, and to say one more thing about this guy, so this was a person who was going into being taken into the emergency room upwards of 20 times a month.
Oh, my goodness.
And after this treatment, he was going less than once a month. So it was like 7 or 8 times a year. So, you know, it was still more than maybe you or I might go, but dramatically less. So that's an example. And he never quit drinking. I mean, he just drank less.
And is it a goal to have people ultimately be able to handle their problems, their medical problems, their diabetes or drinking or whatever it happens to be, so that people will be able to go out into the workforce? Is that part of the whole Housing First program or not?
The goal is, the primary goal is to get people to be able to handle their chronic health conditions, including their drug or alcohol use, to the greatest extent possible, to promote independence, and we're fiercely committed to that, that even 5 years in, we still want to keep pushing toward greater and greater independence. And that may include working, it often does, but I just stop short a little bit, and you'll hear what I'm describing is an approach that's very centered on each individual. So for the person in Unit 302, it may look and feel very different than what we're doing with the person in 303 based on their unique needs. One other thing I want to say about
sure.
Housing First, and you really, I think, highlighted this at the top, is that it's an approach that's been seen to work very well with very long-term, what we would refer to as chronically homeless individuals who have co-occurring health conditions. So the other thing I would say about this group of individuals is it tends to be a population of people who really have disabling conditions. So there are some health concerns that make it difficult for them to have regular full-time jobs, which is not to say that they don't still work, but they might not work in kind of a more traditional 9-to-5.
Mm-hmm. And you've also found, I understand, that most people, after 1 year and even after 2 years, are not out on the street again.
Oh, right. You know, we have a program in Chicago. It's a partnership with Heartland Housing that we're really proud of called Pathways Home. And the ticket into Pathways Home, it's kind of like through the looking glass. It's the opposite of most programs. You have to have a serious mental illness and not want treatment for it. And you have to be using drugs and alcohol and be very committed to doing that and not interested in, you know, going into traditional abstinence-based treatment. So we actually set this program up in 2000 in response to, we looked around and we thought, well, there's something missing in our continuum of services in Chicago, and it's a program, a housing, we were just learning that term, housing first, but then a housing first program that is for this really sort of, you know, hardcore group who's not ready for, you know, traditional routes to recovery. And that program today is still continues. It's very successful. And 94% of the people who move in are there the first day of year two. I'm very proud of that, because it's the first year that's the hardest year. That's usually when people are, you know, they've been on the street for, you know, sometimes we would measure it in years, not months or days. And they're not used to being inside, and they're not used to the kind of expectations that we have in an apartment building. They have a lease, you know. and so that tends to be the toughest year. They're still kind of acclimating. And 94%. It's pretty, you know.
Pretty remarkable.
We're pretty proud of that.
Right. How do you fund all of this? It sounds like there's so much care that this has got to be expensive, is it?
Yeah. So that's an excellent question. On the surface, it may look expensive, but again, if you think about the population that we're doing this, this is a group of people who are consuming a lot of services, both in the healthcare system and often in the criminal justice system. And so we're really, I think of it as rerouting those expenses and actually delivering a very cost-effective alternative. So let me describe a little bit how we fund it, but also I do want to describe, you know, the cost savings. So we fund it through, weaving together funds from different systems. So HUD is a big supporter and a big source of revenue for us to run our programs, housing and urban development. And then in Chicago and in Madison, we're also using the Medicaid program. So the people we're housing are people who have serious mental illness and substance use disorders. So we're able to bill for some of the services and supports we provide them through the Medicaid program and get reimbursed for some of those services and supports. Not all of the things we do, but, you know, if we're counseling someone on helping them drink less, if we're supporting a man, say, to remember to take his medicine for schizophrenia every day and not miss doses, that those kinds of services can be billable. They also are really cost effective. So you've got a case manager knocking on a door every morning, maybe again at night, helping someone take their medicine, and that person now avoids an inpatient stay at a couple $1,000s a day, you're talking about actually some serious cost savings.
We're going to pause for a moment. We have time to take a couple phone calls for you, and then we will just continue on the same topic. We'll just have different people joining us. Ed Stellan is our guest now, Executive Director of Heartland Health Outreach, a part of Heartland Alliance. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, and we are talking about housing first this hour of the program, introduced some years ago, but it flips the model, offering housing to people who are chronically homeless and then treatment. It specifically targets chronically homeless individuals with mental illness. There are programs as well in Madison and in Milwaukee looking at homeless families, too, and getting housing for those people. And well, we welcome your phone calls if you have questions for Ed. This is the Ideas Network. We have time for one or two calls for Ed, and then we'll be talking with Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley and also with Michael Goldberg. Michael is Executive Director of Heartland Housing, part of the Heartland Alliance. You talked about some people going out to jobs. maybe not full time, but people working. Do people pay rent after they are able to work some?
Yes. Actually, people are responsible to pay 30% of their income, whatever that is, toward their rent. So, for instance, if somebody moves in right off the street and they have no income, that would be 30% of zero. A lot of folks have a serious disability, and so they are on disability. So they are responsible then for paying 30% of that disability payment toward their rent, and then the HUD subsidy kicks in for the rest.
I see. Mm-hmm. Let's go to a question from Dean in Madison. Hi, Dean.
Hi, Ed. And Joy, thanks for having this show. I've worked in this field probably as long as Ed has in Madison and in Chicago and other places. And Ed, if you could, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the no barrier concept of housing. I think that's a little confusing for people. And also talk about how big a shift it was away from having people required to stop drinking before they could even get into housing or things like that. I think it'd be helpful if you talk a little bit more about that. Could you do that?
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Dean, so much. So the cornerstone of Housing First is that there are no barriers to housing, that housing is the only real solution to homelessness, and so therefore needs to be part of everybody's plan, you know, to get out of homelessness. So that means that, you know, historically people had to earn their way to housing. So I might move into the shelter and from the shelter into interim housing, from interim housing into a recovery program, and then maybe I'll earn some housing at the end of that. Well, Housing First rests on this principle that in order to get even in the direction of recovery, people need to have housing, that housing is part of that solution, part of that recovery process. Case in point, let's take diabetes, for instance. Very hard to manage in the streets. Very hard to manage. It requires staying on top of your blood sugar and modifying your diet in such a way that you're just literally not able to do when you sleep outside. Housing, on the other hand, becomes part of that medical plan for that person to help him or her overcome that and manage it. Same thing with drugs or alcohol. Harder to stop doing that when you're sleeping on the streets and or sleeping in the cot next to the guy you got high with the day before you went into detox. Very hard to keep your recovery going.
Hmm. And thank you, Dean. Unless you had anything more. No, Dean is gone. We thank you so much, Ed, for being with us and explaining this.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
More power to you, sir.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And I really do thank you for bringing attention to the not only the model, but just even homelessness itself. It's such an important topic.
Yeah, I agree. Ed Stellan, Executive Director of Heartland Health Outreach, part of the Heartland Alliance. We're going to continue. We're talking about the Housing First program, and there are places in Madison, certainly, 3 miles east of downtown. The nonprofit developer Heartland Alliance Housing has brought the Housing First approach to Madison with the Rethke Terrence Project. Is 60 single occupant units, and it's adhering to the philosophy the best way to help homeless people is simply to provide them with a home. Here in Milwaukee County, in July of 2015, the Housing Division launched Housing First in Milwaukee with a goal to house 300 individuals by 2018. And we'll be talking about the collaborative process that's taking place in the Milwaukee area and also looking at what's happening with families. Well, this also, we've talked about single adults. What about families who are homeless? Are there models for them as well? And have we noticed that people are happy with this kind of arrangement. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655 for you to join our conversation. Email, if you'd like to do that, is talk@WPR.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Michael Goldberg is the Executive Director of Heartland Housing, part of Heartland Alliance. Michael, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Great. It's a pleasure to be here, Kathleen.
Yeah, nice to have you here. So tell me about this project in Madison. There is one house right now, the Rethke Terrence Project?
Yeah. So our first initiative in the city of Madison, in partnership with so many local stakeholders, ended up being called Rethke Terrace. And it's just a reference to the address. It's right off of Rethke Terrace, off of Rethke Avenue, on the east side of Madison, and it's a 60-unit supportive housing development, or housing plus services, aimed at housing and providing services for the hardest-to-serve chronically homeless individuals in Madison. And so there's 60 units, and of those 60, 24 of the units are set aside for housing homeless veterans. And so we've got a veterans component as well as, you know, just a homeless component.
Mm-hmm.
And then Ed and his team,
go ahead.
So then Ed, I know you were just talking with Ed. Ed and his team are the service provider, and Heartland Housing is the developer, and then we manage the property.
Mm-hmm. And so you have a 60 unit, and how many people are in it now?
Yeah, we're fully occupied at this point.
Oh, you are fully occupied.
Yeah, yeah.
Great.
So we completed, it's a new construction building. We opened right at the end of May, and through the next several months, we were able to get full occupancy of the building.
Mm. And how did you decide who would live there?
You know, so this is where that coordination takes place. And so Madison has a centralized referral system whereby either through their involvement with a case manager from a social service agency or at a shelter that they may be staying in, the homeless can get registered on this centralized list. And one of the beautiful things about it is through sort of that intake assessment, the vulnerability of that individual is assessed. How long they've been on the street or homeless, living in a shelter. Do they have chronic health concerns? Is there something that would jeopardize or threaten this person's livelihood if they weren't in housing sooner than later? And so we go to that list, and that's how we start engaging the homeless and trying to talk to them about moving over to Rethke Terrace. And that's how the initial lease up for the building went, and that's how we'll continue as units become available. That's where we'll go for those first residents to try and move them into the building.
And how are people enjoying it?
You know, I think the reaction's been overwhelmingly positive for most of the people in the building. You know, everyone's different, and, you know, something Ed said about the service delivery is unique and specialized to the individual. And so I think some really see it as this amazing opportunity to go from where they were, and, you know, many of the residents that we're housing now were on the street homeless. And so the ability to go from that into this very supportive community where, you know, they've got their own apartment. Many of our residents have never had their own apartment before. So a private apartment with private bath, private kitchen, and then this really supportive approach in terms of management and the services that are afforded to you. I think some see it as an incredible opportunity. But, you know, everyone's different, and some folks engage in those services, and I'd say the community life of the building more than others, but overwhelmingly the response has been very positive.
Mm, great. Milwaukee County Executive Chris Abley is also joining us, and I mentioned earlier that the Housing Division in 2015 launched Housing First in Milwaukee with a goal to house 300 individuals by 2018. County Executive Abley, thanks very much for being with us.
Yeah, great to be here.
How are you doing with that goal, sir?
Excellent. Actually, I was going to add a little bit to it. What we announced was to get to a functional zero in chronic homelessness, not just for the city, but for the entire county, within 3 years using the Housing First model. And knock on wood, we're actually ahead of schedule. Last Monday, I was at the White House because we were invited to talk about how we've had that success. From where we are to where we were to where we are, faster than any metro in the country. So that's something to be excited about.
Mm-hmm. How many chronically homeless are there in Milwaukee? Do we know, and how is that ascertained?
Well, as you probably heard in talking to other people, everybody in metro areas does what's called a point-in-time count, that is done through a partnership of a lot of the organizations that work with or service the homeless. And it's a lot what it sounds like. It literally is staff going out to areas that we are that we know of, to the shelters, compiling their numbers and saying, okay, of the chronically homelessness, what's the number? We did that ahead of this this initiative, and I want to say it was a little under 200, but we also assumed that there was a lot more, so we budgeted around and planned for a little over 300. But again, the model is, you know, permanent housing, Housing First. The services are unique to individual. It's a broad array. But most importantly, I mean, the services, the housing, every element, people take on their own terms. And what makes the program so statistically successful in terms of people staying with it is, I mean, at 50% higher rates than other models, is, I think, that sense of taking the services with dignity, which is just, it's great to watch.
Mm-hmm. And talk more about that. What do you mean by that?
Well, the guy who designed the sort of pathways to permanent housing, that element of Housing First, is a guy named Sam Simbaris in New York. And one of the things he had noticed working with lots of folks that we serve in a lot of government service agencies is not everybody wants to take the service. And you can't, you know, you can't force somebody to go to rehab. You can't, I mean, to a point, or to take mental health services to a point. You can't force somebody to take housing. And he also noticed that a lot of times housing was conditional, if you were granted, on taking certain services, whether that was rehab or job training, mental health counseling, whatever was appropriate to the,
yes,
to the person. And realize that when people, a lot of the people who are at that point of accepting help, it's an issue of identity and an issue of dignity. We talk about it in the context of veterans all the time. Veterans aren't used to asking for help, and anybody who works with veterans homelessness will tell you there is a pride issue. People don't want to admit, hey, I need help. But, you know, that's true in varying degrees to everyone. However, if they're owning their decision, they're owning the decision, you know, to take the housing, they're owning afterwards the decision to involve themselves in a program to take services, they are statistically significantly more likely to stick with them. So the benefits that we get when we take a permanent housing approach in the first place are greatly enhanced when we use that approach.
Yeah, interesting. Why is it, let me hear from both of you, we've had issues with homelessness for a long, long time. Why did it take until, I know New York did this in 1992, but this all seems fairly recent. Why all of a sudden have we tried this entirely new approach that seems to be working and we didn't think of it 50 years ago? Michael?
Well, you know, honestly, I think the experience is that we have been doing this for a while, but a challenge with it is that it's just really difficult to put all the funding together to get a rescue terrace kind of development put together. And so there's just a limit on the resources that are available for this kind of initiative. And so if you can think about a building, you have to get the capital you need to build it. Then, you know, Ed referenced that no one pays more than 30% of their income, and often the case, the income is zero. So you need a rental subsidy or some source of funding that can help, you know, in this case it would be Heartland Housing, operate the building because there are, you know, costs for doing that. So that's a second tier of money that you need. And then third, you need the sources of funds that you need to operate the service program. And so it's a lot to coordinate. It's a lot of effort to find those resources and put it together to actually make one of these come to fruition. Mm-hmm. And so we've been doing it for a while. It's just that, you know, the resources aren't there to meet the demand.
Yeah. County executive?
I was thinking I agree with pretty much everything Michael said. I mean, the 92 was sort of the earliest sort of iterations of this type of programming, and we've had a lot of very compelling data about its success for a while. The one thing I'd say also is, there's a lot of difficulty in combining and putting together the resources to cover all elements of this. And, you know, I'm sure Michael and everybody who works for him, and frankly everybody who works in this field, are also very conscious of not wanting to start providing something if they can't be sustainable. One thing that I think has maybe changed a little bit is we also talk, in addition to the cost of providing it, we're talking a lot more publicly about the cost of not addressing chronic homelessness. You know, the average Milwaukee Police Department call for service is almost $1,000. The average emergency room is almost $1,000. You add up, and when you're talking with the chronically homelessness, a population that, you know, around ballpark 70% have issues with behavioral health, it is much, much more cost-efficient to provide housing, in addition to what I think is kind of the moral rightness of it.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think part of the momentum is building around increasing public awareness of the cost of not doing it.
Mm-hmm. The cost of 20 trips to the emergency room in a one-month period of time.
You know, the other thing I think, and I agree absolutely with everything kind of like Abley said, and a little plug that the county exec is, and his office has been incredibly supportive of our work in Milwaukee as well. We have 3 supportive housing developments.
Yeah.
They're up and operating in the last 10 years. But the other thing I think that's really important is that I'm sorry, I just lost my train of thought with that. I'll come back to it.
All right, that's fine. I wanted to ask about families, too. These are for people who are chronic, who are individuals. What about the number of families who are in shelters for long periods of time? Doesn't this model work for them, County Executive Abley?
Well, it's a very different population. I mean, and Michael will know more probably specifically about this than I, but as with behavioral health, you know, it's a population that's not monolithic, and so the right kind of service modality and the thing that people will react to most successfully really varies by individual. I think the chief distinction to understand, though, is that chronic homelessness, so people who've been homeless for over a year or more than 4 times in 3 years, while at any given time a relatively small percentage of, if you took a snapshot right now today, if instead you look at, all right, how many homeless days, people days per year, they represent a much higher percentage. So one thing that happens is if you're doing a good job reducing chronic homelessness, you free up capacity at a lot of the shelters. We've seen that almost immediately. We saw that here in Milwaukee, which means they have more capacity to deal with and provide services for families and other different types and categories of homelessness.
We welcome phone calls for both our guests. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about Housing First, the program in Madison, the programs in Milwaukee, and here's how... Did I give you the number? I do it all the time. I can't remember. I think it's... I didn't. So it's 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. We like to read your comments there. And this is the Ideas Network. We go to phone calls for our guests. And let's start with Sarah in Zion, Illinois. Hi, Sarah.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Okay, so down here in Illinois, I was looking into housing options this summer, and I qualified for supportive housing. I don't know if it's quite the same rules you have, but for qualifying, but for medical reasons. But the thing is, pets were out of the question, and so I'm really struggling to pay rent on my apartment and work full time with my medical problem. So, do you allow pets? And if not, what's the problem with pets?
Okay.
Yeah, I can maybe address that. So, so we manage a portfolio, most of our portfolio, which is around 1,100 units, and in nearly all of our units, we do allow pets.
Now,
it's a manager by manager decision. But we think it really adds to the experience if someone wants a pet, to have that pet often is the case in, and I'm speaking probably more with our senior populations and sometimes our chronically homeless, there can be an element of isolation, social isolation, and so a PET can help address some of those issues. But I think it's usually on a manager-by-manager basis. We just think it's a good idea to allow to have a PET policy, but to allow pets.
Hmm. That's good to hear.
Yeah.
Sarah, thanks. Tom in Chicago. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Sorry, my voice is a little hoarse, but really excited about the topic. I just had a question about how we're ensuring the sustainability of these housing projects, maybe in comparison to some other housing developments that were put in place maybe many decades ago that didn't have the level of sustainability or support, and how they, how these new ideas differentiate from those.
Mm, all right. Chris Abley?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, actually, that was one of the things I brought up at the White House event on this. How do you ensure that by addressing this, we're not simply creating an ever-growing portfolio of units that HUD or Section 8 or whatever sort of public funding is financing, and how is that sustainable? And I think there's a couple of ways to do it. First, one of the big innovations and sort of insights into the Housing First approach, and one of my favorite statistics is it isn't just that 5 years in, it's still a large majority of people who've been taking housing are still in it. They almost invariably have cost society, certainly other social service delivery, ER, behavioral health, first responders, much less than they would have otherwise. But the really interesting one is the percentage of people 5 years in who are still in housing, but they're paying for it.
Oh.
It's the other big, I think, difference is the model isn't getting to subsistence. The model is getting to empowerment. And I think if you know that the statistics around Housing First have had are that impressive, largely because where they looked at it, part of the programming had involved some element of, workplace, work training, work placement, job placement, then there's a really good argument to say, okay, well, let's upfront more of that early to get an even higher percentage 5 years in. So in addition to people coming in, there's people moving out of the subsistence. The other thing we're looking at is typically housing permanent housing is basically an agreement to do the public subsidy, the rent subsidy. One of the things we're looking at is, are there ways we can model the monthly check being going towards equity or essentially a mortgage payment rather than rent? I mean, is there some way that on the sort of public side of the ledger you can hang on to or at least keep some of that value that can be used, both of which would dramatically improve the sustainability? But I think both of those insights, and frankly a lot of the research since the 90s, is subsequent to a lot of those giant public housing developments that were put up in the 70s, which I don't disagree didn't have a lot of research behind them.
Thomas, from this Twitter feed, how do we make the living arrangements safe, drug-free, and crime-free? Michael?
Well, safe, absolutely. Design goes into that as well as management practices. And so there's a lot of thought given to, how you're not only ensuring that the residents and employees of the building are safe, but that, really what you're bringing into a community or a neighborhood is something that's going to increase the safety of a neighborhood. And lots of studies have shown that investments in affordable housing like this and a Housing First would fit within that, are really investments in communities and improving the safety and security of them. But, as was mentioned earlier in the segment, Housing First isn't it's a barriers-free housing model. And so it's not saying day one you have to be free of drugs, free of substance abuse or substance use. It's saying that we're going to work with you where you are today, and we're going to help you make better decisions so that your use of those drugs, your use of those substances isn't going to interfere with your housing stability, and the goals you have and that the program has for greater independence as you move forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, it's important to say that the X we're solving for never presumes we're going to get to absolute elimination of any nuisance or crime or whatever. It's that we absolutely, though, on our worst day, can improve versus status quo. So, I mean, to Michael's point, if you're not providing that kind of service for the sort of person a neighbor might worry about who's got a chronic drug issue and or, you know, a dual diagnosis with some behavioral health issue, if you're not providing for them, you know, they are more of a risk than if you are. And then with the kind of housing options, we have a portfolio, and I'm sure, Michael, and your firm there, you've probably got all sorts of different types of housing with different levels of services appropriate to different populations. But one thing that was really heartening to me is when we started our project here, there's a housing unit specifically for high acuity drug and alcohol addicted folks or people with those issues and mental health, and it's designed to have programming, and it's in a community. And I remember when we were announcing it, people asked, well, you know, what did the community think? Nobody, traditionally everybody says, well, I don't want this in my backyard. Well, we got to say, they're here, why don't you ask them? And they were incredibly supportive, but the reason is we didn't sneak up on them. We spent a lot of time working with what now is my favorite neighborhood organization anywhere, and they got it. They were incredibly supportive, and as Michael said, they understand our neighborhood is better in almost every metric you can imagine for supporting something like this. And by the way, those metrics include how we feel about the people we are.
Mm, interesting. What about the people who you find to occupy these places? Is it part of the Milwaukee Police outreach to the homeless program? And are people wary of you? Do they say, oh, yes, 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 I want to do this right off the bat? Or how does that happen?
Well, there's a couple of different referral sources. We do work with police departments and first responders, fire departments too, actually. An awful lot of their calls involve not just homeless, but specifically chronically homeless. And a lot of times they, you know, they want to do the right thing or be supportive, but just not sure what that is. So when we have more resources and facilities for them to go to, but also we have our own staff that they know they can call any time, and we'll say, look, hey, just hang on, we're on the way. We've got caseworkers who can get there and be, you know, make sure that whoever gets the appropriate care, so they can spend more of their time being, you know, first responders, and we can get a better outcome. But it's an, you know, it's an all the time thing. Getting to functional zero doesn't mean you're never going to see anyone who could be chronically homeless again. It just means if you do, it's because we haven't gotten to them yet, and we're proactively always looking.
How about Madison, Michael?
Yeah, so I would agree. We've taken this similar approach to what County Executive ably described. The other area that we've taken a very proactive approach to is the City of Madison helped fund Heartland Health Outreach to do direct outreach to homeless on the street. And so we had staff literally going to those spots that you sometimes see individuals or small groups of individuals, and you know they're homeless, but engaging those people and, you know, establishing a relationship with them, building some trust, and ultimately led to many of them getting sort of assessed for that centralized system that we talked about and ultimately finding housing. So both referral with our network of social service providers and first responders and direct outreach.
Mm-hmm. And so far, there aren't any complaints. This has been up and running in lots of places, cities and throughout the country and also outside some cities, I understand. It's hard to find people who say this isn't working.
Well, I would agree. I mean, I think you'd be really hard-pressed to say, to find anyone who didn't think it's working a lot better than it ever has. And, you know, we have a lot of, and I'm sure Mike would agree, I mean, one of the most heartening experiences you can have is when that relationship has been built with someone who's been homeless for years, and there is that trust, and they make the choice to take that unit, and that realization that, this is yours
right.
for how long,
yeah.
as long as you want. I mean, it's just, it's very hard not to experience that and not know, hey, we're doing right by society.
I
mean,
imagine.
This is what we're supposed to do.
Yeah. Thank you both. We're out of time, Michael. I'm sorry. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Yeah. Our thanks to County Executive Milwaukee, Chris Abley, and Michael Goldberg, Executive Director of Heartland Housing, part of the Heartland Alliance. Thanks to KP Whaley for producing this hour, to Zeb Gozman for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your calls. I got some family issues, and then everybody coming home. I got to cook. I'm not a great cook, so it's going to take a little while to do this. I wish all of you a wonderful Thanksgiving. I know for many of us, it's our favorite holiday. Lots of good food and good conversation, and the family's coming home from so many places in the world. So I wish you a wonderful Thanksgiving, and we'll be with you again on Monday. John Munson is here tomorrow. He's great. Have fun with John and all his great topics. And thank you for listening.